this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 28, and I'm joined by Len Lawler, Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of Philosophy here at Penn State, and co-director of the Society for Phenomenology and Existentialist Philosophy. Len is the author of many books and articles on phenomenology, 19th and 20th century continental philosophy, and French postmodern philosophy. And I will only mention here two of his more recent book publications because they're related to the discussion we're about to have. So the one is This Is Not Sufficient, an essay on animality and human nature in Derrida, which was published at Columbia University Press in 2007. And another recent one is The Implications of Immanence Toward a New Concept of Life, published by Fordham University Press in 2006. And as you can hear from these titles, Len's recent scholarship has focused on the questions of the human and animal life and on the philosophy of immanence, which he associates with postmodernism. He has graciously agreed to join me today on the Digital Dialogue to talk about an essay entitled Anachronism and Powerlessness, an essay on postmodernism. And one thing that I want to ask about at some point in our discussion is if this is related to a larger book project and what that is. But it's really a great pleasure to welcome you, Len, to the Digital Dialogue.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks, Chris.
So for those who haven't heard you give this lecture or haven't read it, can you just talk a minute about sort of what you're trying to do in it and what the overall structure of it is?
Well, I think it was good that you mentioned the last animal book. Everything that I've written recently is comes out of that last animal book on Derrida and animality, and so this paper is an attempt to think about the constitution of a new kind of community. Mm-hmm. And I appropriated some of Derrida's writings, or Derrida's wording, mm-hmm. where he has constantly since the 1960s worried about how to constitute a we. Right. In the sense of we are alive, or we are the people, or that sense of the pronoun we. Mm-hmm. So in this paper, I was trying to do two things, one very obvious, one not so obvious. First of all, the kind of we, which would be a change in the way human communities think about themselves and function today and in the future, but also mm-hmm. to think about a concept of the we, and this was more submerged and maybe not so visible in the paper, to make the boundaries of what counts as a we mm. quite porous, right. and therefore to include animal life as part of any we that we might think about, we humans might think about, to right. include them within that right. community, right. Rather than having a kind of anthropological border which would be exclusive.
Right. Well, one of the things that I'm glad to hear, maybe we can come back to that second point, because the book that I just at the publisher now, related to Aristotle's understanding of truth, I try to flesh out an account of Aristotle that focuses on the question of voice, which I know comes up in this essay, and that blurs the boundary between the human and the animal in an interesting way, because of course Aristotle gets pinned down with this as the person who establishes that rigid distinction. Right. So I'm really happy to hear the blurring of that boundary. But maybe we can come back to that, because I like this idea of these two aspects of the we question. But I wanted to start maybe by asking about the beginning of the essay, where you do a kind of phenomenology of or at least what I would say as a phenomenology of internal experience or of thinking, right? You begin with this right. question of thinking. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought that nicely drew the question of immanence into relation to the question of heterogeneity, and I think that seems to be an important part.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I think I actually called a phenomenology at one point.
Yeah, I think you did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at the end of the description, I call it a phenomenology, and it's very much inspired by Husserl, but also by Bergson to some degree, and but it's also in those pages, the opening discussion, which is a very long discussion. This is probably not so clear, but I where I'm trying to actually include animal life. Hmm. Within interior monologue. I mean, it seems it's not, I don't say it, but so maybe make two points about mm-hmm. this. One is that, and you might know better than me because you know the history of philosophy better than I do, but But it does seem to me that one of the ways the division between humans and animals has been done is on the basis of the fact that we have self-consciousness right. in a way that animals do not.
Right. Right.
So that we have an interior monologue, which is gives us knowledge of ourselves, and therefore, just to use like Cartesian language,
mm-hmm.
I know that I exist because I can have this self-consciousness.
Right.
So I was trying to criticize that type of foundation of self-awareness to show that humans don't have it, don't have that type of self-awareness, that type of self-knowledge, in which case it's possible, therefore, the difference between humans and animals is not as rigid or substantial as one might think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wouldn't amount to saying there is no difference, but it would
right.
still mean that the difference would have to be rethought.
Right.
Where I explicitly wanted to bring in the animal, and this might sound quite insane, is when in the description of interior monologue, what I was trying to show is the use of natural languages.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me,
mm-hmm.
natural languages
right.
involves indeterminacy in them, and therefore, so that I have to have my interior monologue in English, it requires I use certain types of phonemes.
Right.
Maybe a certain type of cadence or rhythm, which would not be alien to, say, animal noises.
Right.
Bird songs.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned birds, because that's actually the example that I use in the when I try to trace the question of the voice and the meaning of articulation in Aristotle in the De Anima, because he does say, and also in other texts and biological texts, Aristotle does say that birds can articulate, and actually I think it may be related to their whole question of temporality, because you do there's a couple lines in the essay, I think, drawing on Derrida about the time being out of joint,
right,
and the Greek word for joint is arthros, which was where we get arthron for, which means articulation. So there's a way in which the question of actually, at the end of your essay, when you bring in the question of the new sensitivity that you want to articulate, I think is, from my perspective, would be something that we would share with animals, in the sense of our ability to be sensitive to our environment in certain ways that respond to it.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And I like, so can you talk a little bit more about the I don't want to say grunting, but there's gasping, there's this, what did you call it in the essay?
Murmur.
Yeah, exactly. Murmur,
yeah.
Right.
Well, I haven't worked this out yet. I mean, I'm still worrying about it, and so I don't really have a lot to say about that. I mean, I fantasize sometimes, this will be closer to your own area, but I fantasize about writing interpretation of the Theaetetus,
mm-hmm.
I cited at the very beginning of the paper, but where I would take that image of the aviary image of memory in the Theaetetus,
right,
and try to literalize it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So rather than have it be an image, I actually think about having animal life as part of the constitution of what I call memory.
Right.
Murmur is a kind of indeterminate sound, but so indeterminate that it might be understood in terms of human language, but also understood in terms of, say, maybe even the rustling of leaves in the forest.
Right.
In fact, I wouldn't even... Again, I haven't thought this through, so
sure.
I don't know. I don't want to sound completely mad, but I wouldn't even want to exclude that technological sounds like maybe car horns or mechanical industrial sounds, things
mm-hmm,
like that,
mm-hmm.
to make it that indeterminate, but to show that indeterminacy within us. And therefore, there's a kind of alterity,
right,
which displaces, to use as classical Cartesian language, the foundation of the I think.
Right, right.
Which, of course, as I, you know, is at least my little comic book version of the history of philosophy, that I think is the foundation for autonomy,
mm-hmm.
in Kant, and
right.
Autonomy. And we all know sort of Kant. Kant is very anti. Will not extend the concept of autonomy to animal life,
mm-hmm.
and therefore we really see a rigid animal-human distinction in the Kantian concept
right.
of autonomy,
right.
which I would think is based on the Cartesian cogito, and
right.
and therefore to attack that, I think, by means of this this description.
Yeah. Well, and so let me ask you just kind of a strategic question then, in terms of your thinking, because, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but it's taking the traditional values that philosophy has held dear. So nous as the highest expression of, you know, being in a certain kind of way, and therefore because humans have that, we that sort of differentiates us. What you're suggesting is, on that economy of values, is to sort of, the move is to degrade, in a certain sense, human cognitive abilities or whatever, or human capacities, in order to blur that line. But I wonder if something, another kind of move is also involved, that that animal life on that traditional value, economy of values, let's say, would have to also be thought as brought up in some ways, or raised a level. Do you know?
Yes, I do.
Or did we just get rid of the economy of values altogether?
No. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we do. But it's just a very complicated question. Strategy, because I think that is a. I mean, the word strategy in my ears always means there's certain risks.
Right. Sure.
And it is a risk that I'm taking in this discourse to lower the value of human cognitive ability.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think it's a different kind of strategy than, and I mean, I'm pretty familiar with the animal rights discourse as it developed in the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the strategy there, which I don't think is a bad strategy, I mean, it has to be taken seriously, but it's an attempt to show that animals have the same capacities or very similar capacities to humans.
Right.
So it's a way of blurring the line by taking a positive characteristic and trying to find that same characteristic within animal life.
Right.
So that the great apes have seem to have some sort of sign language, whales have some sort of communication that seems like human language.
Right.
So they seem more worthy of moral consideration than, say, I don't know what, squirrels or rats.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing, and this is, I think, what Derrida is doing as well, is taking away a positive capacity from humans and then showing the same lack of positive capacity in animals. And I think that makes for a more interesting, I hope, and more fruitful way of differentiating, not based on a common characteristic, but based on the lack of a common characteristic. So that you wouldn't end up, I mean, one of the risks of the animal rights strategy would be as kind of homogenization.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between humans and, say, higher mammals would look very small and maybe, insignificant. But I think that by basing the continuity in a lack, the possibility of making more differentiation seems possible. At least that's the gamble I'm taking.
Right. Okay, so there's a couple things about that. No, I think that's exactly right. This is really interesting from my perspective because would you agree with the characterization of what you're saying is the sort of last 20 years of animal rights activism as almost really on the Enlightenment model of equality, right? Let's make everybody equal, and therefore that's why they get rights, whereas the strategy you're taking and the strategy that I think Derrida's articulating is not to eschew the incapacities, not to deny the human incapacities, and to say, look, that's actually part of what relates us to the wider natural world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if that's the case, and I think that's that's a good strategy, then I think we need to hear a little bit more about how you get from that concept of immanence to the heterogeneity, because it, I think they're related insofar as the lack that one experiences in that internal monologue and the way in which the voice of the other, voice understood really broadly, is always operative in that monologue, becomes critical to thinking about how the animal life in our life.
Yeah, that's a very good question as well. I mean, I've thought a lot about the concept of immanence, and I mean, you know this already. I mean, there are certain decisions you have to make philosophically. So I've decided to valorize the word immanence in my discourse, and you wouldn't have to do that actually, but it seems to allow me to assemble a lot of different ideas. One is the traditional phenomenological concept of immanence. So that's why I start with interior experience, which is how immanence has been defined. for maybe centuries, maybe since Kant at least. But the idea is to, immanence has a sense of withinness and inclusion, so that allows us to move towards an inclusion of alterity. But especially, immanence has to be reconceived as a way. Yeah, I'm not sure even how to express this correctly, or in a way that makes some sense. Immanence has to be understood in a way that does not include a kind of overarching unity.
Yeah, right.
So the immanentist thinking, it's not a very good word that I've coined, but that's I've decided to go with it. Immanentist thinking would be non-hierarchical and would be egalitarian, but without there being any type of measure for that egalitarianism. So it's a kind of, and Deleuze has this phrase, plane of immanence, and I think plane has to be understood as a kind of flat surface, so the distinctions are lowered down, but only insofar as they are not being measured any longer by a kind of prior value concept unity. And once that prior value goes away, then immanence is constituted by a multiplicity of differences. But all of which have the same, I'm going to speak quickly and maybe need more elaboration, all of which have the same value.
I was going to say, you're thinking that you're hesitant to say value. But I mean, the value comes, it has to be completely immanent, right?
Exactly.
So the value, there's no, I mean, part of what you're talking about is that there will be no external measure.
Exactly, yeah.
There will be no external ideal, whatever, to impose upon. So I think I really appreciate how embracing immanence in the way you did, and I you know learned a lot about from the implications of immanence book when you were interviewing here. I read that and it was really an eye opener for me. I like particularly also how you associate it with the postmodern movement. I'd like to maybe ask a little bit about that. But the real power of it comes in the way in which it undercuts the totalizing structure of, you know, how value is established and legitimated, right? So that because there's no more outside, any kind of values has to be articulated and defended from within.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so then, I can hear sort of people saying from a certain side, well, doesn't that just mean it's just the play of values or whatever? I mean, I think at least for my own some of my own philosophical commitments, I think that's always the challenge is to articulate a position that doesn't fall into this kind of totalizing model, but also doesn't recede then into just the mere play. Of forces. I wonder what you would say about the mere play question, if I've even articulated that in a way maybe that's not a fair, but anyway.
No, of course it's a fair question. I mean, I mean, there's always this worry about relativism. I assume that's what you really are referring to with the play idea. And, I mean, it's a very difficult question, and I think this will sound like a very inadequate answer, but I mean, if I'm right about how the concept of immanence has to be conceived, and the strength of that necessity has to be conceived that way, is going to come to me, going to come from reflectional experience.
Right.
So if the structure of experience is a certain way, then it has to be the case that we have to think in certain ways that are adequate to the way that experience works. And therefore, the relativism, if you want to call it that, it's relativism to a structure of experience which cannot be overturned. And you know what Derrida calls the undeconstructible. I would think that is not a value insofar as we usually conceive values as something that I know and can define. But the undeconstructible is indefinable because of the structure that it talks about is, say, composed of heterogeneous elements that cannot be harmonized. So there's a kind of adequacy is required to inadequation. But that adequacy still gives us something very loosely, like, I wouldn't say a value, but I would actually go with the word truth.
Yeah, well, actually,
and therefore, that, I mean, adequation is a language of truth.
So that
I would probably, like Heidegger, at the end of the day, circumvent the discourse of value and go maybe in the direction of some sort of renovated concept of adequation.
Right. Well,
and that would give me the ability to criticize any mode of thinking that didn't take this irregular structure experience seriously.
Right.
I mean, criticism is really the direction that this would go more than anything, rather than a positive theory.
Right.
I know that.
Well, no, that's, and so actually, this is really great for me because, so this book on truth in Aristotle really draws on, you know, certain strands of American philosophy, but really I'm on Heidegger's conception of truth. And so just to give you a quick broad stroke of it, because it's related to exactly this issue, the argument basically goes that what Aristotle actually helps us think about is not truth as correspondence, but as co-responsibility, that is the ability to respond together with the things that we encounter, be they natural or human, natural in a broad sense. And then the question of adequation then becomes critical, namely, are we responding to things in a way that does justice to how they show themselves? So that's where the phenomenological part comes in for me. But that's also how I get a kind of accountability and a kind of, I agree, not value, but truth. The question of truth is at stake there if we think of truth as justice, namely doing justice to our experience, what we encounter, the things we encounter. And so I try to play that out with respect to Aristotle's text, but I think it's very much in line with what you're articulating.
Well, I would say exactly. Yeah. It sounds very similar to it. I mean, there are other aspects. I don't know what that means, a co-responsibility to, what do you say, the natural world or something like that?
Yeah, I would say to the things we encounter, and I would say even what we encounter can be our internal experience, to put it in, you know, subjective terms.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And responsibility is a good word to introduce here in terms of this whole question of values and relativism,
right,
is responding to the way experience works.
Right.
Use experience as kind of a looser term than say, subjective experience or immanent experience, something like that. Just talking about experience.
Right. That's what was really exciting me about when you talk about new sensitivity, because part of how I play this out in Aristotle is with regard to the question of aesthesis and perception, and that as a middle-voiced verb in Aristotle, which means in some ways that what we're doing, even when we're perceiving at the most rudimentary level, is we're corresponding, we're responding together with the things that are being perceived. So we're at once active and passive in that. The things that are being perceived are active and passive in that. And that relationship is really very dynamic. But I think a sensitivity to that dynamism at once gives you the capacity to think about adequacy, but always with the gesture, just what you call in this singularity, it never congeals into a unity,
right? And therefore, there's a kind of incompleteness to the adequacy. You
know, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why I think the vocabulary that you articulate of immanence, and then how there's, would it be fair to say, an imminent otherness? I mean, otherness is bound up with imminence, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, the logic of it, and whether it's not good logic, would be that with the elimination of a hierarchy based in, say, self-awareness, that immanence becomes a field of multiplicity and differences. I mean, that's, again, very simple way of doing it, but so that what is within ends up looking very different than how we would normally think of internal experience.
So the two main words in the title, anachronism and powerlessness. We talked a little bit about the powerlessness, although I'd like to maybe talk a little bit more about that, because I liked some of the formulations that you had about the powerlessness as an ability in a way.
And that would circle back to what you were saying about animal life having sort of more than what we have. I mean, if you, and this seems to be a very central idea in Derrida, that that when we define human life in terms of certain capacities, we are actually narrowing down mm-hmm. a set of capacities. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you criticize the privileged set of capacities and say, well, actually, they don't function the way they do, that looks like a kind of powerlessness. But by taking away that delimitation, it actually opens up the possibility of there being other capacities that one would find.
Right.
And therefore, if you say, well, what defines humans is we have this ability to be self-knowledge, be self-aware in a very clear way, we argue, as I did here, mm-hmm. that's not really true.
Right.
What do we find? Do we find something that's less than that or more?
Right.
And I would argue actually you find something more mm-hmm. by getting rid of that delimitation. But those privileged capacities had actually differentiated us from animals. So all of a sudden, if we take them away, we get down to animals, but then what counts as animal life has this maybe great range yeah. of capacities that we didn't actually
right.
Have thought about
sure.
because of being enclosed within this right. other set.
Not only haven't we thought about them, we don't value them. Like
exactly,
the range of hearing of a dog, for example.
Right, exactly, you
know,
yeah.
That would be an example of something that, you know, although we do value hearing, but there might be a whole range of things. So, I mean, in a sense, you're really, by making that move, you really are also calling into question the whole economy of values that have been operating in terms of the Western philosophical tradition.
Well, that's a very, very large claim. But
I mean,
I guess the short answer is
throw it off. Why
the
not?
Short sure. answer is yes. But I mean, that's not unheard of in the last 200 years.
No.
I mean, you know, within Nietzsche's doing
right.
the same thing.
Right.
And everything that, I mean, that Heidegger, Derrida, Deleuze, Foucault, they all right. work out of the tradition of Nietzsche's right. thinking. And so I'm just taking a small step with them.
Yeah.
So,
but that actually brings me to a different sort of, I mean, a related sort of question, which I was thinking about when I was reading this, which is, what does, if we take this imminent seriously, it does mean something specific about how we have to do the history of philosophy in the sense that, as you point out about memory and about the past dimension of temporality in experience, we're always inheriting something. And so there's a way in which philosophy has to be done through its history, and even if we're throwing the values, the traditional values off, we're still embedded somehow in that.
Yeah, of course. That makes... Yeah, I mean, I'm not by any means jettisoning the history of philosophy.
No.
I mean, I don't know. I don't. I mean, I've gotten on. I mean, for better or worse, I've appropriated all this language of overcoming metaphysics that Heidegger has.
Yeah.
I may be the only person left that actually says things like this, as far as I can tell. So maybe I now it's sounding very outdated, but I do believe that the sort of accepted concepts out of the tradition should be severely criticized,
mm-hmm.
but in, you know, I mean, you can invoke Foucault's sort of idea of minor histories or subjugated knowledges, and that if one eliminates these more dominant strains of thought, I'm not sure what one finds
right.
in the history of Western thought.
Right.
One, so to speak, digs below the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So there are possibilities there that are maybe not explored. I mean, I'm sure you think
yeah.
you're doing this with Aristotle
yeah.
yourself.
Right.
And it says, no. But it is an attitude towards the history of philosophy that I would think is very much like Heidegger, that certain concepts that play themselves out in certain ways, and those concepts have to be criticized and gone beyond.
Right.
I mean, Derrida talks that way too, and although it was somewhat more caution than Heidegger, I think, at
mm-hmm.
times, though it's always difficult to know what's going on with Heidegger.
Mm-hmm,
But yeah, I don't have the same... I mean, I have an attitude where the historical positions have to be criticized first to see what lies below them, and
right.
not a kind of celebration of the history
right.
for its own sake.
Right. Yeah, no, and I mean, that's what I was... I was trying to think about how embedded in the very notion of experience that you say really, in my language, has to hold us accountable. We have to be accountable to
right.
experience, the inadequate that is, and that which can't be really done justice to in a full sense. But and so that that it seemed to me was what it meant in some ways that what we're always involved in is a taking over of that. So we even, let's just say, the strategic move to put your the emphasis on imminence. Well, that implies the longer history of the story of transcendence sure. versus imminence and all of that, right?
Sure, and so. But I mean, it's also a term that, yeah, I think it's a term that's valorized only in the modern tradition,
right.
starting with Descartes, and therefore it has to be seen as a term in the discourse of anti-Platonism.
Right.
Right. So again, that's a very specific relationship to the history of Western metaphysics.
Right.
Is to appropriate the word immanence and then right. to go down the Cartesian path, but then transform the Cartesian path to show that there is a field of multiplicity that constitutes the I think.
Right.
And that's the experience that is really the measure for all these other distinctions and concepts that one would develop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so again, I've also appropriated this language of anti-Platonism, which may also isolate me from many people working today, but for better or worse.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, and we talked briefly, I think, about this, it's, you know, I'm as long as we make a distinction between Plato and Platonism, I'm
sure.
okay with anti-Platonism, because as I think wrote in the email to you about this, that I do think if we do take the dialogue, read the dialogues in a certain kind of way, you can get a really pretty powerful imminent reading of it. Where you, if you just say, "I'm going to just take the way these texts have been structured and not try to read into Plato's intentions from the outside, but see them as bound up with the literary structure," which actually brings me to the other thing I wanted to ask about, which was narrative and what's going on with narrative in your essay, because you trace this strand with Lyotard from the primitive to the through the modern to the what you call the economic. Maybe
right.
you could talk a second about that.
Yeah, I mean the Lyotard is there for a particular reason. I'm interested in Lyotard, but the writing of this paper, it came about for a very contingent reason. I was invited to write for the Oxford Handbook to the Self.
Uh-huh.
And so my assignment is to write the postmodern self. So there's a somewhat different version that will appear in this Oxford volume in to the end of this year, in 10.
Okay.
But because of the assignment being postmodern, the word postmodern is a Lyotardian term.
I see.
I went to Lyotard only for that reason. It wasn't part of my research agenda.
I see.
Yeah, a year ago when I wrote this. But the part about narrative is, for the ideas I'm trying to develop, is it does seem that in Deleuze there is an idea where literature or fiction, again, it's very strange, one of these strange intersections with Heidegger,
mm-hmm.
Where Deleuze seems to think that literature and poetry can bring forth the kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
And Deleuze, you know, is very anti-nationalistic literature and peoples, but he does hold on to this idea out of the Romantics, German Romantics, of an idea of a people that Heidegger has. I start to realize when I work on the postmodern condition and the differ in these two main Lyotard texts, which are written at the same point in time as Deleuze is writing A Thousand Plateaus,
mm-hmm.
that there was more similarities than I expected to find
right.
in this idea of a constitution of a we or a people based in the idea of a kind of body of literature, poems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the narrative is there as the possibility of calling forth a new kind of we
right.
or people.
Right.
I haven't gotten very far in this idea, and the ideas in the last pages. I have only one other essay where I even attempt to talk about this kind of what this literature would look like.
Mm-hmm.
I've not really gotten very far in it, except that the idea that it can't be defined in terms of a central concept. Whatever
right.
whatever is going to be expressed in this literature can't be something like a formal idea, which would allow the literature then to have more effects than than we could foresee.
Right.
So that whatever people be called forth would not be defined in a way that they couldn't be called French or American
right.
or Turkish or whatever. They'd have to go beyond any type of singular name because of the indetermination in the very type of literature that would call them forth. Again, taking up a language that you find in Derrida and Deleuze, I use this literature of the secret
right.
idea and as a way of pointing towards the lack of knowledge
mm-hmm.
at the root of the whatever the novel, the poem, the folk tale
right.
That would have to be written to call forth a different kind of we than what we have right now.
Right. Well, just a quote from the last page, because I thought this was a poignant passage, where you say, what we would have is an ever-changing cloud of stories calling forth these friends, and you call the friends of passage, and I want to talk in a second about what that means, but these friends, let me start over. What we would have is an ever-changing cloud of stories calling forth these friends whose proper names are never able to be appropriate because they are letting others pass. So that actually does get at this idea of friends of passage. Well, maybe you can just pause there because I want to make a different kind of point, but pause there about friends of passage and what you sort of mean by that. If you can remember.
No, you said I remember. I was trying to do it in three or four
yeah.
sentences.
Right, right.
It just, well, I mean, the way the paper works and the way a lot of the things I've written the last 5-7 years I've worked is based on reflections on temporalization.
Right.
So like in English, but also in French, passé, the past mm-hmm. involves this word passage. So if temporalization is the way in which I am unable to keep alterity out.
Right.
And again, just very simply, if you think about how time works, and this is basically just very rudimentary phenomenology of time,
sure.
is that there's no ability, I don't have the ability to have a now, the current moment, separated from an anticipation and a very quick memory, a very immediate memory.
Mm-hmm.
But that anticipation and quick memory, they are different from the now. So the difference in alterity is always included no matter what I do. It's a necessary structure of the way time works.
Right.
Is that the anticipation is letting in another and other pass into the now, and the memory is bringing back an other
right.
into the now. Now, it seems to me that it's possible one could try to resist that necessary passage. So the friends of passage would actually be ones who let the other moments or others
mm-hmm.
pass into
mm-hmm.
The present.
Mm-hmm.
So the friends of passage, I've invented this phrase for better or worse, but it does, it's supposed to have this temporal connotation, but also obviously passage as a spatial.
Right.
So that, ideally, or when I have more time, I would want to take this in the direction of actual worries about borderlines and immigration, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear the Heideggerian language, which is always kind of ethical, let passage happen.
Right.
So it does seem to me that there is a reaction to the necessary inclusion of alterity within the present, a reaction to resist it and try to stop
right,
it.
Right.
So that the friends of passage would actually not do that and reverse that impulse and actually invite it
right.
to happen.
Right.
So
so
you can hear the language of hospitality
and
things
definitely.
Like that. So
and that's actually leading me to think about a kind of separate issue, which is that if we take passage also in the term in the sense of something written, which I know at the end you have some a very strong connection between thinking and writing, and that seems to be certainly at the end of the essay an important a point that you want to emphasize. But I like that when that the formulation friends of passage also has the notion not only of the we, namely the community of friends who might cultivate habits that allow the passage to happen, but also that they and we would have to be friends of the passing, of the passage,
right.
and the passing, and this temporality, and the temporality that we are, bound to.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That says it very well. Yeah. having the writing part at the end. Again, the end is really the end. I mean, I not got very far beyond.
The last word is Heidegger, by the way. I know, I'm sure you made that on purpose. I just wanted to say I recognized it.
The first word is Plato, and the last word is Heidegger.
There you go.
Yeah, it was very conscious.
Very nice.
But it is a worry about what we do as philosophers, and it does seem to me the one thing that we do is write, and that is a kind of activity, not necessarily political activity, but it is activity that does bring about certain changes in our culture, and therefore, I would want to valorize the work that we do as having an effect, and it happens by means of writing, primarily. Mm-hmm. So, writing is inventive. So, insofar as this literature is indeterminate, it does allow us to create more different ways of talking about the same ideas or the same problems. Right. So, right.
Well, and then here, and I warned you about this in my email. So this is, I do think that there's something from my interest in sort of what's happening right now in terms of social media, the technology, and all this this real proliferation of a certain kind of writing, and some of it, you know, just stream of consciousness stuff that's, you know, whatever. But my strategy in some ways with this project and with some of my other work is to see if I can't get into that environment and bring some of the liberal arts values and some of the philosophical values to bear in that. And I see this actually in some ways, and maybe I'm just completely wrong about this, but as analogous to the transformation that happened in ancient Greek time from an oral tradition to a writing tradition. And now what we have is the transition from a writing tradition to a different kind of writing that includes a whole lot of a proliferation of kinds of writing, be it through video, pictures, commenting, and all kinds of things, audio, hopefully, you know, podcasting and things. But I'm wondering if sort of what's happening and what we're living through is can be related to what you're talking about, a new kind of literature and a new kind of, and as related to this Friends of Passage idea. All right, brow is furrowed right now.
It's a hard question in some ways, but I mean, and the short answer would be yes, why not? And but I do think it's important when you said analogous.
Right.
I'm not sure the technological advances are very different from other modes of communication.
Right.
And clearly the extent, the duration of these technologies is greater. The universalization power is greater.
Right.
But that universalization power was probably virtual or potential in oral discourse anyways.
Sure.
So I'm not sure it is that big a change insofar as it can be used for the, use your words, philosophical and liberal arts values.
Yeah.
That's good, but of course, with any type of technology, there's always dangers as
well. Exactly.
And therefore, one would have to be able to assess the risks and benefits of it as one did with regular graphic production and oral production as well.
Well, and that brings me to the great Phaedrus.
It does bring Phaedrus as well. But,
right.
But the interesting thing is that if the literature is indeterminate that I'm trying to talk about, it does seem to me that the preservative character of this technology makes the murmur behind that literature tremendous, because I mean we all know what we can do now on the internet and find all these very obscure writings and texts. I mean, I don't mean obscure in the sense of, you know, obscure writings from the Middle Ages, which are available online, but obscure writings by your people you met once and somehow get an email from a blog site and but the murmur and therefore the indetermination seems very great because of this, and that might be the place where I would put the difference from other technologies of communication that were developed in the last 2,500 years or so. So I would think it might be very relevant to the idea that I'm developing at the end of the paper, but still being a little wary of the homogenizing, of course, obviously with universalization, universalization always implies continuity and homogeneity, and maybe that's also being, the murmur is being increased, but also the sort of, lack of murmur, the
right.
hum, the one hum
right.
is also
right.
coming to be more evident.
Sure.
So maybe the combination of those things that was in graphic production, is now becoming much more explicit with
right.
this type of technology.
Right. Yeah.
The diversity and the
right.
and the lack of diversity.
And I would say, I think that those are all important points. One, just the point back to the Phaedrus that's, I think, interesting is although Socrates in that dialogue is very critical of writing, we know Plato obviously wrote, and that's the only reason really why we have these things. So that was that preservative character of writing is really vital in that sense. The question of the preservation of these kinds of things, the podcast, a blog post, and all that, I'm that's in some ways up in the air because they're always there, but on the other hand, they always they have to be saved on on things, and so the technology is obviously
that's very similar to written,
right?
Of
exactly.
course, as well, I mean, the archive can be still burned down if it's
right.
The servers can be
right.
destroyed,
right? Right.
So the same problems. That's why I'm saying the analogy is important
yeah.
that it
has
it
continuity.
Isn't, it is, yeah, there's continuity, and therefore the problems that we had in the past are still problems that we have with this
right.
technology.
Right.
Maybe worse or maybe better. I don't know.
Yes.
So.
Well, and the thing that I think is interesting with regard to the question of passage is that as you get into sort of trying to get your mind a little bit around some of the stuff that's out there, I mean, it is so enormous, it is so gigantic that you do have the sense of the. Of a kind of alterity that one couldn't get one's head around, a kind of almost singularity because it's so big and so dispersed. So there's a way in which you sort of emphasize the murmur side, but you also can have it I don't know if this is one side versus another, but in terms of the proliferation of voices.
That's
and,
the same thing.
Right.
I would say that's
yeah.
what I'm aiming
right.
for with the murmur.
With the murmur, idea. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I
right.
agree entirely.
Yeah.
No, and that's why. I mean, I mean, I'm not Heideggerian in this way in terms of rejecting technology. I mean, I think it's an. I mean, you too. Obviously, it's an interesting phenomenon. I'm not sure what it means yet.
Yeah,
I would certainly, if someone told me this is a gigantic event, unlike any we've seen in the world, I would be very
right.
suspicious of that right off. But I would think that maybe what you just said. The proliferation of diversity and diverse voices does seem magnified
mm-hmm.
here in a way that never before
right.
have we seen that.
And the way that certain groups, certain people can come together, coalesce
yeah.
for some
yeah.
time around some issue, around some common thing, and then disperse.
Just in the paper
right.
today, repressive regimes are trying to get rid of Google
right.
and things like
Twitter
that.
And all that. Yeah.
So,
right.
So no, I agree. It could have a great political impact. It does already have a great political
right.
impact. That's again, I wouldn't be Heideggerian. I mean, at least in Heideggerianism,
right?
It's not clear to me what Heidegger is actually doing with technology. But the way he gets popularized is that he's anti-technology.
Yeah,
I would not
yeah,
go down
no.
that road. So,
right. That would be. Well, that's actually something that I've been thinking a little bit about with regard to the notion of poiesis in Heidegger as. Also, to use my language, a kind of way of responding. And if we think more originally about what technology is, even on Heidegger's own terms, as a kind of poiesis, in the positive sense of poiesis, then I think there's a way of undermining that caricature of Heidegger as anti-technology. But I also think that the points that you're making about a we that is non-totalitarian are those points are important. And one of my real interests with this podcast and with some of my other work that I'm doing is, part of having part of this idea of a non-totalitarian we would mean cultivating habits, abilities, let's say, and inabilities also, to be honest with it, that would allow us to become friends of passage, to use your vocabulary.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, how do those...
Well, I don't know. I would need to think about that a little bit. I mean,
uh-huh.
I understand the language of habituation out of Aristotle.
Right.
And, And clearly everyday life and everyday decisions cannot be made without habituation. But I would still be a little suspicious of that, because it does seem to me that one of the... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is, again, you're at the edge of what I understand about what I've said, but I would think the worry, my worry would be that that the experience of I'm calling anachronism, would be too sedimented. I mean, put below the surface, where the habits would function, and therefore kind of requirement for thinking might go away, might not be so evident. So, I mean, one of the things that I think is implied by what I'm doing, and certainly by what Derrida is doing, is to, I mean, what the purpose of a deconstruction is to make an experience happen for us where we take responsibility and actually not function according to habituation, but actually say, well, reorganize the habits. But I do need to think about that more. I mean, well, I know this is part of the discourse of phronesis, and phronesis is not alien. I mean, that's why you keep coming back to sensitivity. I know.
Yeah, and I mean, this can be part also of an ongoing discussion between us, because I think I want to reconceptualize, or at least try to be true to what I think is the Aristotelian conception of hexis, which does involve, you know, which does not involve those that regimented kinds of habits that we learn by rote, but is actually an active condition of the soul, which would be more analogous to what I think you're talking about as a new sensitivity. So, but anyway, that's a larger discussion and maybe a good way for us to end this episode of the Digital Dialogue. I really appreciate you coming on, man. It's been great.
Okay, thanks. Good.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.